In Acts 17, this is a verse that Philip read last week, Dr. Ross read as he was speaking. In verse 22 of that chapter, Acts 17:22, reading as he was talking about a little bit different message, but Paul in Athens. This is not the Athens where I live. Different Athens for all the Athenians. Verse 21 he mentions, and then 22, Paul stood up in the midst of Areopagus, that's a meeting place they had there, and said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious." So he noted that this was a religious people, not in the sense of the word of Christian religion, but he had been touring the city and found statues and objects everywhere to all kinds of different gods there. So Paul noted that, and he said, verse 23, "For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship," many objects of worship he found there, "I found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.'" And that kind of struck me last week as I saw that, "To the unknown God." And perhaps you've been seeing lately more in the news about the loss of Christianity in this country, the rise of atheism, the loss of faith, which direction we're moving. There was a bit on CNN last week about the millennials and their rising. And I noticed not too long ago an article about rising atheism. They're choosing a word that sounds good, because atheist is one we have bad connotations with, and we don't want that. It's kind of like the same-sex couples marrying. They chose a word a while back when I was young that was a better word, and they decided we would be gay, and that's a nice word, and went with that. And the atheists, I saw in an article, are calling themselves bright. We are bright, and that kind of implies that we must be dim on the other side. So this brightness that they're using, I would say, is really a darkness, and it's a profound darkness. And we're seeing that in the country, and we're seeing what Paul says here, this inscription, "To the unknown God." And God is very unknown in our country. We're finding that too. People don't know who God is. The world doesn't know. Even God's physical nation, the descendants of Israel, don't anymore know who they are. So the title of this message today I have in Mr. Davies' first slide is "The Unknown God Reveals Himself." I'd like to consider this past and present, because a lot of what we have in the Bible is an example for us. And we're going to see again things similar to what I want to look at today. The unknown God reveals himself. And let's look back into history. The history of God's people. And second slide. I've got Abraham here. I just pulled these off the net. And let's see, can you hit, you go into full screen. I might get those a little bit bigger. These are artist renditions of what these people may look like. And this is a history of people of God as we move forward into time, and we're still doing that. I could have gone further back than this. Could have gone back to Adam and Eve when they were created, and they chose, instead of God, they chose Satan as the revealer of knowledge and truth. And we know that God said, "Well, you can live your life as you choose. That is something that I allow. It's not a good choice, but you did that." And we know in Genesis 6, 2,000 years have passed as God backed away. And then God said, "They became so depraved. I regret I even made them." Strong statement from God, but we have to continue into the next verse, because God knew this was going to happen. He knew if we live our own way, this is the way we would go. And the next verse, he said, "I regret I even made them, except this man Noah." And God is choosing people to work with. And so we had the flood, and God is starting over again, and we move forward, and we get to Abraham and his time, and God looked around and said, "It's time to start a new effort towards saving my people," part of the plan. And we wonder how God chooses people, or I do sometimes, and I think when he looked at Abraham, he said, "Well, here's someone I believe who will listen, who will follow, who will work with me." And that surely must be involved with the calling of God's people. I know I heard a minister once, and we all sit and wonder, why me? were kind of the least and the lowest in too many ways. And the minister commented, I think in large part, God said, I believe that person might listen. And so we have Abraham and Isaac here in the lower picture by the well with his to-be wife, Rebecca, and then Jacob. And these are men that God worked with, and these are individuals who knew God, in contrast to the unknown God. And from Jacob, the next slide, we know Jacob had 12 sons, 12 children, who became the 12 children of Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel, and these are the 12 tribes of Israel. And this one circled here, Joseph, had a huge role in God's plan, was selected for a huge role. Next slide. This Joseph is the great-grandson of Abraham, through whom God made many important promises. And we know he was sold into slavery in that picture there. And he was sold into slavery to another religious people, as we had read about in the Athenians that Paul was encountering. It's kind of hard to imagine how they could have become that bitter, his brothers, to do this. And even how people can exist that are happy to buy this young fellow who doesn't want to go, but nonetheless, that's what's occurring here. And it makes me think, too, Jacob was not a perfect man by any means. He created this kind of turmoil in his own family by showing favoritism too much to one child. And look what we have from it. There are a lot of dysfunctional families out there with main people God's working with. So I kind of look at myself and say, welcome to the club, sometimes with things like this. So that's part of God's plan, though, is this proceeded and Joseph was sold into slavery to a very religious people. And the next slide will show many of these false gods of the people to where he went, where he found himself. The Egyptians were quite religious where he was taken. But in the false religion or pagan sense, they had a huge variety of gods. Many depicted up here, according to some historians, over 2,000 that they worshipped. A huge variety of things, protection, blessing of their crops, fertility. And they were convinced of the importance of trying to please these gods. There were, according to one reference I found, 39 principal gods depicted among many minor gods, and they found these in Egyptian art. You can see the stone carving in the lower left and the lower right. There's another stone carving. These are on their monuments, on tombs, in temples, and then color is added to these, and that's what we have up here to make them more like things they would have had that didn't last through time to depict these different gods. Many of these are human-like with the head of some animal, part animal. The one on the top left is Horus. They're a falcon god, god of the air and sky. The one next to him is Set. I don't know if I need a pointer, just in case I'll pull that out. And Set is a composite animal god. He's thought to be part giraffe, part donkey, part anteater. Informing this god, he's the god of storms. Anubis is down here, third from the end on the other side, right here with the head of a jackal, and called their jackal god. He's the mummification and afterlife god. God of the afterlife is part of worship of these gods. Being part animal, their priests cared for many temple animals that were considered sacred. Next slide shows some of that, again from carvings in the buildings that they show. Yeah, thanks, John. And here we have a priest in the temple caring for a temple bull, considered to them by them to be sacred, representing their god Apis, the bull god. Here's falcon again for Horus. A statue in there. Here's a statue of a cat, or a carving that was found representing their feline goddess Bastet. So there were many goddesses and gods that they worshipped, and they were quite serious about that worship. That is the religious climate into which Joseph was sold, into which God's people grew and became slaves, and where over 400 years of passing, they forgot who God was. God became the unknown God. They had heard some, but they largely forgot who God was. The rescue and the exodus of Israel from Egypt then is a fascinating part of the history of the church, history of God's people and salvation, and it included a necessary battle between these false gods and the true God of Israel. While these false gods were Egyptian gods, they were also Israel gods by that point. Many of the Israelites had adopted their beliefs and the customs of Egypt. We can look into Joshua to see that. Look at Joshua 24. Deuteronomy, Judges, Joshua 24 and verse 14. And we see here, this is after all the miracles God had done in the Exodus. And now we've arrived at the promised land. Joshua 24, verse 14. Here Joshua speaking, he says, "Now therefore, fear the Lord. Serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the river," back where we came from. So the Israelites were involved in this too, having lived with Egypt. On the other side of the river and in Egypt. Don't serve them, serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourself this day. It's time to make a commitment. Get on one side or the other. Who you will serve, whether the gods which your father served that were on the other side of the river or the gods of the Amorites where you're dwelling now. And then he makes his choice, his statement. "But as for me and my house, we will serve God. We will serve the Lord." So it was for this reason it was important for God to reveal not only to the Egyptians, but also to the Israelites, who the true God was. And even while hearing of him, those who still believed in him would wonder where he fit in among these Egyptian gods, who were gods also and were worshipped. So keep in the back of your mind as God does this and reveals to the Israelites who the true God is, that we're going to see something like this again as we push toward the end of the age. There are many analogies toward what happened, or between what happened in Egypt and what will happen in the end of the age, as God again now has largely become the unknown God who people don't know and will have to reveal himself to his physical nation, descendants of Jacob and Israel, as well as to the world, and take back his children from Satan. So back to Egypt now, though, as with all the false gods, theirs were in reality just a tool of Satan, as they are to gain worship by Satan for himself. Satan, the god of death, god of pain, god of destruction, god of hurt, instead of worship of the true God, God of life, who is God of happiness and all good things. And we find this in his spirit and what that imparts to us, can impart to us. Let's go to Exodus 12 now and go back to where this starts. Exodus 12, and Mr. Petty talked about this today. I didn't know what the subject would be, and I think that was a change in our schedule to have the Beyond Today, but I had us going to Exodus 12, and in verse 1 here, as God begins this work, he said, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, 'This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you.'" They had no idea what this meant, what God was doing, what it was all about. "Speak to all the congregations of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for the household." So what we see here is God is instituting the Passover. And they don't know that at this point, but he's saying, "This lamb is me. We're going to kill this lamb. We're going to put the blood around the sides of your door to protect you," knowing that it represents him, that he would be allowing himself to be killed. He would let himself be put to death by a world. And as Mr. Petty showed, it is largely clueless as to who God really is. And as we're moving today in this country with the atheism that's increasing and our diversity of religions, and people don't know anymore. And lots of times when people ask me, I don't say I'm a Christian anymore, because it means such diverse things. I say I'm a religious person. if they want to know I'm a religious person, and if they want to explore that further, I will, with what that means. I did that a couple weeks ago with a woman I was communicating with by email who was part of the National Institutes of Health, where I'm going for a meeting, and she said, I'll have to step aside for major surgery that could be life-threatening. And I said, well, I'm a religious person. I will say my prayers for you. And she came back with, me too, God will take care of me. But you know, Christian means different things, and a lot of people it means bad things, and we're falling away from that now in so many ways, I'm afraid. So here God's instituting the Passover, and Christ knows, he's saying that I will be this Passover in verse 12. For I will pass through the land on Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn. And I was talking yesterday with a coworker about kids and disciplining kids, and he said, I tell them, I don't like this any more than you do. You know, you're my kids, I love you. I don't care for this at all. And that's the way God is in this. I will pass through, I'll strike all the firstborn. And Christ knowing that, hey, I'm a firstborn too. I'm going to let myself be killed. I'm one of the crew here. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. I'm willing to do this too. This isn't anything God enjoys, but when we accept Satan's way of life, there's a lot of pain getting out of it. And this is part of the pain that we'll see as we move forward. In the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. And note what he says to Moses here. Moses, I am God. Moses, too, who had been in Egypt with all these false gods, I suspect wondered if any of them were real gods. And the God he heard about and indeed had talked with was another one. I don't know, but God says repeatedly as he works with Moses, I will execute judgment. I am God. It's me. I'm God. We could see this in Numbers. We don't need to go there. But Numbers 33 and verses 3 through 4 brings Israel out of Egypt and to the promised land. And looking back says, I executed judgment. I did this on all the gods of Egypt because I am God. I am the true God. It's a message we keep getting. It's something God had to do to these people, for these people, to reveal who he was. It's something God will have to do again. As we get further into the end time, it's a very interesting study to compare the plagues of Egypt to the plagues of Revelation and what happened there. So in the book of Exodus, we have recorded for us, for our instruction too, 10 separate plagues directed by God against the Egyptian deities. And by this, God showed both the Egyptians and the Israelites that their made-up gods were powerless. They're just that. They're just made-up gods. They cannot assist them. Praying to them or otherwise giving them homage was of no value. While having numerous false gods, which we saw on the first slide, we can go to the next slide too, John, it shows these false gods, Pharaoh had no recognition of the true God. None whatsoever, like we're finding the world moving toward. This is where we're going in Exodus 5. We can see that. Let's go back to Exodus 5. In verse 1 of that chapter, Exodus 5:1. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Lord God of Israel. Moses talking to Pharaoh. Thus says God, my God, let my people go, that there may be a feast to me in the wilderness. And Pharaoh said, Pharaoh grew up with what's on the slide up here, all these gods, these are my gods. I don't know this one you're talking about. And Pharaoh said, verse 2, who is this God that I should obey him? Why should I care? Why should I obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know him. I do not know your God. I know Ra, the sun god, and I know Horus, and I know Set, and I know these other gods here. I do not know your God, nor will I let your people go. And we'll find that Pharaoh clung tightly to his gods. As we continue through this, notice what Pharaoh did in response to Moses' request and the idea that there was another God who might compare or even exceed Pharaoh's gods, the Egyptian gods. In verse 4, very familiar, and the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor. Get back to work. And Pharaoh said, look, there are many people in the land, and many people now, and you make them rest from their labor. So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters to take their straw away, but not reduce their quota. So they had to make the same number of bricks, but they had to work harder to do that. Verse 8, the quota is the same. You're not going to reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry out, saying to us, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. The God Pharaoh doesn't know. Pharaoh said, let more work be laid on the men, that they may regard, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. So that's what Pharaoh believed about this God Moses was speaking of. Pharaoh punished the Israelites, and Moses kind of got caught in that. We see he complained to God about this in verse 22. Moses returned to the Lord and said, that's why I wonder sometimes if he kind of believed in these other gods too. Why have you done this? Why do you trouble this people? Why is it you have sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered them at all. He's kind of questioning here. He's not real happy with the people grumbling at him. And verse 6, then the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand he will let them go. With a strong hand, he's actually going to drive them out. He's going to want them out so powerfully. And God said to Moses, God spoke to Moses and said to him, Moses, I am God. So he's telling him again, Moses, I am God. Not these gods of Egypt, not this other system. I will take care of it. So we're aware that God had provided Aaron, Moses' brother, to speak for Moses. We don't need to go there. It's just a page over in Exodus 4 and 10 where Moses said, I don't want to do this. We were talking about this on the way in today where people declare, you know, I'm a prophet. You find that most prophets in the Bible really didn't want the job. And God moved them into it, and Moses said, I really don't want to do this. I'm slow of speech. I can't go in and talk to Pharaoh. This isn't going to work. And so God provided Aaron to him and sent them to Pharaoh in Exodus 6 and 29. Then we read as they stand before Pharaoh, or moving there, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, Moses, I am God. And we hear this again, and it's quite a frequent thing we find here as we read through. I am God. Speak to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said before the Lord, behold, I'm a nobody. I am of uncircumcised lips. Why in the world is he going to pay attention to me? Will he listen to me? So the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh. Or you will represent me to the point that you will be like God to him. The way he will look at you. And Aaron, your brother, shall be your prophet who I have provided. I have provided you a spokesman. And then we begin to see the power that God will provide for Moses. As I read through this myself, it kind of made me think about the two witnesses who are coming and how they'll be associated with the plagues of Revelation as Moses and Aaron were with these plagues on Egypt as we go forward. And in verse 9, when Pharaoh speaks to you saying, show a miracle for yourselves. Why don't you prove yourself? A lot of talk I've heard, not much action. Show a miracle. Then you shall say to Aaron, take your walking stick, your rod, and cast it before Pharaoh, and let it become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh, and they did this. Just as God had said, and when Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, it became a serpent. Became a serpent. You know, this isn't immediately recognizable and something I hadn't appreciated, but a confrontation was already beginning between the true God and the false gods of Egypt. And you can see on this slide here, there are some snakes in this slide. And among the many gods of Egypt, there were serpent gods. Here's one, you know, the god of the underworld, Apep, and another one, Wadjet, on the side with the sun on its head, the snake goddess. So they had snake gods and goddesses as well, would have looked at these as something representing their gods. And you know what happened here as we go forward. They did this, every man. Verse 11, Pharaoh called his wise men and the sorcerers, the magicians of Egypt. And these were magic workers and sorcerers. And they also did in like manner with their enchantments. And every man threw down his rod, and they became serpents. But God's serpent won. So this was a beginning battle between gods of Egypt and gods of and the true God. God's snake ate their snakes. And in verse 13, Pharaoh saying, well, these aren't among our more powerful gods. I'm not too worried about this. Pharaoh's heart grew hard. Verse 13, he did not heed them as the Lord had said would happen. So the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hard. This is with his own pride and ego. This was a man with a very heavy ego and pride. And he refuses to let God's people go. He's not going to accept the God of Moses and Aaron over his gods. And with this, the 10 plagues and 10 major defeats of gods of Egypt began. The first plague was aimed at the most important resource of the Egyptian culture, its life giver and sustainer. And that's shown in the next slide. This is the Nile River that they worshipped. You can see the Nile River here coursing through Egypt here. There's the Nile River beside the Red Sea. And over here, Saudi Arabia. And here's Israel right here. Beautiful river in many areas. Beautiful river. So the first plague is aimed at this river. It was very important to the Egyptians because annual flooding left the silt deposits that grew their crops and made the land fertile. And otherwise, they were in an area of tremendous desert and sand. And you can see this is a satellite image here of the Nile River, more current version. And you can see the land around. It's greener than it looks in this particular slide. And then as we get away from the river, it turns to sand. And it's sand for hundreds of miles in this part of Africa. In every direction is desert. So this river was very important to the Egyptians. And it made the land around it quite different where they lived and where they survived. And the Nile was therefore worshipped by them. Prayers were offered to Hapi, H-A-P-I, the god of the Nile. And the next slide shows some colored carvings of this god, Hapi, who would bless and care for the Nile as their water source and their provider of food. In Exodus 7, then, verse 19, Moses is sent to Pharaoh. The Lord spoke to Moses, say to Aaron, take your rod and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their streams, over their rivers, over the ponds, and all the pools of water, that they may become blood, and there shall be blood throughout the land of Egypt, both in buckets of water and pitchers of stone. And Moses and Aaron did so as the Lord commanded. So he lifted up the rod and struck the waters that runs in the river in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, where all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood. The fish that were in the river died, and the river stunk. And the Egyptians could not drink the water of the river. So there was blood throughout the land of Egypt. And then the magicians did so with their enchantments, and Pharaoh's heart grew hard. So he did not heed them as the Lord had said would happen. And Pharaoh turned and went into his house. Neither was his heart moved by this. So all the Egyptians dug around the river for water to drink, to get water that was not changed to blood, so that they could not, because they could not drink the water of the river. And 7 days passed after the Lord struck the river. And by this plague, let's go to the next slide. God showed that he... Okay, I skipped a slide, so that's fine. That's good, John. You can go to that one. It shows the Nile as a river of blood, and then shows them looking at fish die. And the next slide is where I was heading for. I must have missed a slide. We're to the frogs. That's okay. We're going to frogs anyway. So we'll go there. But by this plague, God showed that he, and not Hapi, was in control of the powerful Nile. And prayers that the Egyptians would have been offering to this god Hapi to restore the river went unanswered. So the next plague, I kind of like this slide because I grew up catching frogs and just love frogs like that. Fun to play with. Sold some to the kids across the street. I'd sell little ones for a penny and big ones for 7 cents. And the man yelled across the street when he got home to my dad, Harry, did your boy sell frogs to my girls? Well, they might have. Gee, thanks, Harry. That's what he said. Now he had to deal with those frogs. But anyway, the next plague, second plague, targeted another powerful god. powerful Egyptian god, Hekt, the god of frogs. And so we see some frogs here. Why were frogs important to the Egyptians? They did have a tremendous number of gods. And in this case, they were associated with the flooding of the Nile. When they had a good year, when they had good flooding, there were more frogs that were associated with the good floods. When they had sub-average flooding, that meant fewer frogs and poorer crops in those years. So for this reason, they worshipped frogs through the god Hekt, who was symbolic of good crops and also blessings in the afterlife. And this god was strongly worshipped by the Egyptians. Let's see if the next slide shows Hekt, a human form god with the head of a frog and found in many of their carvings, and again with color added here. So in chapter 8 in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your territory with frogs." Now Pharaoh knew what was being said here, and he would say to himself, "My God is stronger than your God. Hekt will protect me. Hekt is in charge of these frogs. This won't happen. So the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed and into the houses of your servants and on your people and into their ovens, and they'll be everywhere. These frogs are just going to be everywhere. They'll come up on you and all your servants." Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your rod over the streams and over the rivers and over the ponds and cause the frogs to come up into the land on the land of Egypt." So Aaron did this in verse 6, and frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. As a kid, I don't know how many frogs it would take before I thought that wasn't really cool. But they really got in the way. And then Pharaoh called out, verse 7, "The magicians did so with their enchantments, and they brought up frogs on the land of Egypt. And then Pharaoh called out to Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord, entreat your God. I've been praying to my God, heck, nothing's happening. Entreat your God that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people. And I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to your God, to the Lord." And Moses, kind of a political answer here in a way, Moses said to Pharaoh, "You accept the honor of saying when these frogs will disappear, when I should intercede for you, for your servants, for your people, to destroy the frogs from your houses, that they may remain in the river only." And Pharaoh said, okay, maybe it was evening, tomorrow. Let's have this happen tomorrow. So he was put in charge in a way. And he said, Moses said to him, verse 10, "Let it be according to your word, that you may know there is no one like the Lord our God." So he threw it into Pharaoh's hand there. Regarding verse 7 in this section, the magicians did so also. And this is something we've been seeing as we go. I looked a little bit about this. What I'm reading here is Gill's exposition of the entire Bible, commenting on verse 7, "The magicians did so with their enchantments, by their secret wiles and juggling tricks, but what they did either was only an appearance, deceiving the sight of Pharaoh and his people, or real frogs were brought to them by the help of devils, but not such in such numbers, and besides, this was adding to the plague, not diminishing it. Had they done anything to that purpose, they should have removed it at once, but they couldn't do that and destroy the frogs. But that they could not do, of which Pharaoh therefore entreated for the removal of them by Moses and Aaron. Their god Hekt had failed them. God showed that he, not Hekt, controlled the frogs." Slide 13, next slide. I've got the numbers written down. And so here's a situation where there were just frogs everywhere, and God was showing, I'm in control of this, not your God. And so Pharaoh had to request that these frogs be removed. And in verse 13 of chapter 7, chapter 8, okay, back to where, okay, verse 13, "So the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, out of the courtyards, out of the fields. They gathered them together in heaps, and the land smelled pretty bad." The land stunk, it stank. The next two plagues involve insects, and like frogs, why insects? In Exodus 8 and verse 15, we see this starting. But when Pharaoh saw there was relief from these frogs, he hardened his heart and did not heed them as the Lord had said. So the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land, see, so that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. How would you like to participate in this one? As you look down at the dust and you say, you know, it's kind of moving. It looks like a little sea of motion down there. It's starting to move everywhere. Look at the next slide. May become lice. Not attractive creatures. That's an up-close view of one lice, one louse maybe. Is that singular? Someone's hair full of eggs of lice and down their neck, damage done by having lice in their hair. Not a very fun thing to have happen. So Aaron stretched out the rod, and this happened in verse 17. They did so. They struck the dust of the earth. It became lice on man and beast. The ground became alive. It started moving. All the dust of the land became as lice throughout all the land of Egypt. Now the magicians so worked. Things are changing now. God is starting to change things a bit. So worked with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they were unable to do so. They could not this time. But there were lice on man and beast, and the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. Here, they're starting to recognize. Pulpit's Bible commentary, I checked on that for verse 19. Comment, the magician said unto Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. The intent here is of a God. It is not probable that the magicians believed in a single God or intended in what they said to express any monotheistic idea, like there's only one God. What they're saying, there's a God involved in this. All they meant to say was, this is beyond the power of men. It's supernatural. Some God must be helping the Israelites. I'm still just reading from the commentary. No doubt they had come to this conclusion by a careful evaluation of all the miracles so far wrought by Aaron and Moses. The magicians were minded to resist no longer. This is the work of a God. But Pharaoh was otherwise minded. And in the rest of this verse 19, Pharaoh's heart grew hard. He did not heed them. As the Lord said to Moses, rise early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh as he comes out to the water. And then say to him, thus says God, let my people go that they may serve me. Thus says the Lord. Or else if you will not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms on you. And I read swarms, your Bible might say swarms of flies. In mine, that's an italics word. And these may have been flies, and it's popularly believed that's true. Others believe they're mosquitoes. Some people believe they're beetles. I think I've got the mosquitoes around our house this year. Can hardly go outside, there are so many mosquitoes. We'll send swarms on your servants, on your people, into the houses. The houses of the Egyptians will be full of swarms. However, it says, of flies, and also on the ground on which they stand. And in that day I will set apart the land of Goshen. So things are changing. The last plague, the magicians couldn't duplicate it. In this one, God said, I'm going to set apart my people now. So the Israelites, too, were learning that these Egyptian gods aren't doing much, but the God of our history is. And here in this case, God says, now I'm going to start separating my people. They need to learn a lesson, and they'll learn too. My people, where they dwell, there will be no swarms of flies there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land. And they would say, hey, this is my God too. Next slide shows swarms of flies around the Egyptians. There's a biting fly. When I was in college, I was a lifeguard and worked at a pool that was up against the woods, and there was a creek that wrapped around that pool. And these deer flies and draw flies and horse flies would come up and land on your back and you wouldn't feel them, and then they'd bite you. I hated those flies so much. I shouldn't have done this, but I was just a kid. I sometimes would catch them. I remember pulling the wings off one, threw it, and just let it walk and walk away. Mad at fly, another one bit me. I managed to catch it, and I was mad at it, and I pulled all of its legs off. It's kind of terrible. And flew, let it fly away. So, yeah, go ahead and land now, buddy. Well, that's the way a kid thinks anyway. That's what I did to that fly. These flies are pests, you know. and whatever insects they might have been were a terrible plague on the Egyptians in this case, and not the Israelites. And these targeted another god, these insects, the lice and the swarms of insects targeted their god Kheper, K-H-E-P-E-R, who is the god over the insects. And the next slide shows this god. He's typically pictured with the head of a scarab. So he's got the head of a beetle. Down here is one of these beetles carved in a rock wall. And here he sits with his scarab head. And you've probably seen these scarabs you can buy, especially if you go over to Egypt and their pyramid areas representing this god. So the Israelites were again learning that the Egyptian god had no power. Praying to Kheper wasn't changing anything. The bugs were still all around. This time God showed that he could protect them while still afflicting the Egyptians with the insects. And with the insect plagues, God showed that praying to Kheper was to no avail. Part of their problem was, if these were beetles, they were sacred. They weren't allowed to stomp them. They couldn't pull their legs off and let them fly away, or their wings. They weren't allowed to harm them. So while they were bothering them, they weren't allowed to hurt these insects. So God is showing that he is in control of this Egyptian god as well. In let's go to Exodus 8 now, in verse 25. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, "Go sacrifice to your God in the land." And Moses said, we can't do that. We can't sacrifice here. It would not be right to do so, for we would be sacrificing." You remember that early slide when it showed the Egyptian priest taking care of the bull in the temple, the bull god? He says, "We're going to be sacrificing the abomination of the Egyptians, something that you hold sacred but is a false god, it's an abomination. We'll be sacrificing that to our god." So pulpit commentary says, "So many animals were held sacred by the Egyptians, some universally, some partially, that if they held," this is the Israelites, "a great festival anywhere in Egypt, the Israelites could not avoid offending the religious feelings of the Egyptians." And so that's what Moses is saying here in verse 26. "We'd be sacrificing the abomination, false worship, of the Egyptians to the Lord our God if we sacrifice the abomination, part of your false worship, before their eyes. Will they not stone us?" We can't do that. Death in Egypt was the penalty for harming one of their holy animals. Verse 27, "So we have to go. We will go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he will command us." And Pharaoh said, "I will let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only you shall not go very far away. Work with me on this. Intercede for me. Help me with this." And Moses said, "Indeed, I am going out from you, and I will entreat the Lord, and the swarms of flies may depart from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from the people. But Pharaoh did not, but let Pharaoh not deal deceitfully anymore in not letting the people go and sacrifice to the Lord." So Moses went out from Pharaoh and entreated the Lord, and the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and he removed the insects, the swarms, from Pharaoh and from his servants and from his people. Not one remained. But Pharaoh hardened his heart at this time also, neither would he let the people go. And in chapter 9, the Lord said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh and tell him, 'Thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For if you refuse to let them go and still hold to them, behold, the hand of the Lord will be on your livestock, the cattle in the field, and the other animals listed here.'" So the fifth plague affected the livestock of the Egyptians. Their livestock were under the control and protection of the bull god Apis and the cow-like mother goddess Hathor. Next slide should show those two. Hathor was also goddess of love and joy. Bulls were kept in their temple, as we saw. When they died, they were mummified and buried with great ceremony and reverence. The fifth plague struck at this false worship. In verse 4, "And the Lord will make a difference between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt like he did with the swarm of insects. So nothing shall die in all that belongs to the children of Israel. Then the Lord appointed a set time, saying, tomorrow this is going to happen. And Pharaoh got up, and dead animals everywhere. And Pharaoh sent someone to go over to the Israelites and take a look. Did this happen to them too, or is it just us? Verse 6, so the Lord did this thing. Verse 7, then Pharaoh sent someone over to look, and indeed, not one of the livestock of the Israelites was dead. But the heart of Pharaoh became hard, and he did not let the people go. The sixth plague then was one of boils, painful sores. Verse 8 of chapter 9, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, take for yourself a handful of ashes from the furnace and let Moses scatter them toward the heavens, toward the sky, in the sight of Pharaoh. And it will become fine dust in all the land of Egypt, and it will cause boils that will break out and sores on man and beast throughout the land of Egypt. And the next slide shows, I think, one of those boils on the arm. I remember when I was young, rubbing my arm, wow, that hurts. And I looked down, and just like in that picture, had a boil on my arm like that, and I showed it to my mother, and she said, well, let's bring you in. We went to the doctor, and he said, yeah, that's a boil. He said, 8 or 10 days, it'll go away. Keep an eye on it. Make sure red lines don't start streaking out from it, showing blood poisoning or advancing infection. But I remember that thing hurt here. And so this struck in verse 10. They took the ashes, and Moses scattered them, and they caused boils to break out on man and beast. All these boils, the doctor says, probably a spider bite or something that caused that. In my case, with all these boils, the Egyptians would turn to their god of medicine and their god of healing. And these are shown on the next slide. Imhotep, if I'm pronouncing that right, god of medicine, god of healing, Toth. And so they're pictured here. And so this again is a battle where God shows your false gods. You can pray to them. Go ahead, pray to them. And the boils won't go away. Worse than that, the court magicians themselves were covered with the boils. In verse 11, the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils were on the magicians and on all the Egyptians. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. See, God stirred up this pride, this ego in this man, and he did not heed them, just as God had spoken to Moses and said, harden the heart of Pharaoh. And in verse 16, why was that? And God says, indeed, for this purpose I have raised you up, making use of Pharaoh and this attitude in him and his clinging to false gods. And again, it's not something God particularly enjoys, but this is part of when we choose Satan and get in the way of that. That I may show my power in you, and that my name may be declared in all the earth. This was a lesson to be recorded for all time, recorded for us as well in this book. And in many ways, again, as I indicated, this is a type or a precursor of similar events, but much more severe, that are coming at the end of this age. The seventh and eighth plagues were aimed at remaining crops of the Egyptians. Chapter 18 of Exodus 9. Behold, tomorrow at this time I will cause heavy hail to rain down, such as has not been in Egypt since its founding until now. Slide 20, next slide shows, I think, this hail, large hail and damage to crops from that. And windshield of a car here hit by a very large hail in someone's hand. We might notice here at this point, some of the Egyptians were saying, this god of theirs seems more strong than ours. And as we continue reading, verse 20, he who feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh, they were probably taking a chance doing this, made their servants take their livestock and flee into the houses. So they were starting to turn and believe that, hey, this god seems to be beating our gods. The Egyptian sky goddess, Nut, N-U-T, I guess is how that's pronounced, was worshipped for her control over the weather, and is shown in the next slide. And see how she wraps around them, and at night all the stars are part of this goddess. And the question then was becoming, could she protect them from this hail that God was sending? verse 22, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven that there may be hail in all the land of Egypt, on man, on beast, on every herb of the field throughout the land of Egypt. So the hail came as Moses stretched out his hand, and it did terrible damage, as we read through here in verse 28. Entreat the Lord that there may be no more mighty thundering. This is Pharaoh now saying, tremendous thunder and hail, for it is enough. I will let you go. You shall stay no longer. And so this goddess could not protect them, and Pharaoh had to petition the God of Israel again. But was he ready to change? Verse 34, when Pharaoh saw that the rain and hail and thunder had ceased, he sinned yet more, hardened his heart, he and his servants, and they would not let the children of Israel go, would not let them out. We're still proceeding through somewhat, well, powerful gods, but not Egypt's top gods. And perhaps Pharaoh is thinking, when we get to that battle, we will prevail here, when we get to our sun god or some of the others. In chapter 10, verse 3, so Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh and said to him, thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go that they may serve me. Or else if you refuse, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your territory. And so we see this happen. Verse 12, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land for the locusts. And the next slide shows these locusts coming in, and Moses said, they will eat everything. Everything that's left of your crops. And there's a plague of locusts. I'm not sure where that was filmed. And every once in a while we hear about these coming in or a picture taken. Crops were blessed and protected by the Egyptian god Seth, or Set. We saw earlier, you find this both ways. The next slide shows this god, who, as did all the others, now fell before the true God of Israel. So prayers to him, this God could not protect their crops either. By the seventh and eighth plagues, Pharaoh was watching his remaining life support systems, their crops disappear, and his gods were falling. In verse 7 of chapter 10, Pharaoh's servant said to him, how long shall this man be a snare to us? And it makes me think again of the two witnesses when they come with their plagues, and what will happen. Let them go. Let Israel go, that they may see it, serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet realize that Egypt is destroyed? Don't you recognize we're done, we're beaten, we're destroyed? And in verse 20, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart and stirred up his pride, and Pharaoh would not let Israel go. Ra, the sun god, then, was among the mightiest gods of the Egyptians. Ra was the source of life, bringing light and warmth to the earth. The next slide shows some of their pictures of the sun god, very powerful Egyptian god. The ninth plague then was impenetrable darkness. And we live in that now. It's just a different kind of darkness with the unknown god, God becoming unknown, different kind of darkness, so thick that evidently even their lamps would not break through it. Verse 21. And that's of chapter 10. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which may even be felt. So the Lord stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. And they could have turned their lamps, lit their lamps, lit fires. But verse 23, they did not see one another that would not penetrate, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. Makes me think when we were in Virginia, too, we had caves there. They weren't caves open to the public, just on the sides of mountains here and there. People knew where they are, and we'd go back in those. And we might go a tenth of a mile in. It would just whine and go up and down and around corners. And I'd say to the boys, sit down on this rock, and we'd turn our lights off. I'd say, that's total darkness. It was so dark. Next slide, I think I put in something just to kind of represent darkness and defeat of this sun god. You couldn't see anything. And that's the way they were. In spite of prayers and petitions, the Egyptians must have now been bringing to Ra, among their most powerful gods. Their sun god did nothing. And finally, we reached the tenth plague. Exodus 11:1. And the Lord said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Egypt, on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out of here altogether. The final God, needing defeat, was Pharaoh himself, who the Egyptians believed descended from Ra. Next slide shows some of these statues we see of Pharaoh, and there's a large statue of Pharaoh guarding the temple of Ra. Pharaoh's co-gods were Osiris, judge of the dead, Horus, the god of the air, again, and others. And we often see Pharaoh sitting with these gods because he is a god in the Egyptian culture. Worship of pharaohs by the Egyptians can still be seen in the great pyramids they made as tombs to these pharaohs, in the huge statues, in their carvings and architecture. You know, the Great Sphinx over there in Egypt seems to become, as a form of the sun god, Ra, who Pharaoh descended from, with the body of a lion. And I think the next slide shows an image of the Sphinx there. I thought it was interesting. It was about 3 weeks ago. It says July 10th in my notes here. Archaeologists digging in Israel say they have made an unexpected find, the feet of an Egyptian Sphinx, and that's what's pictured here, linked to a pharaoh building, to a pyramid building pharaoh. Between the paws of this find is the hieroglyphic inscription with the name of King Menkaure, who ruled Egypt during the Old Kingdom more than 4,000 years ago and built one of the great pyramids, and that was on Fox News. Verse 24 of chapter 10, of chapter, I think I'm in 11. No, I can't, because there's not 24 verses. So I'm going to go to 11, verse 4. Then Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight, there we go, I will go out in the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land shall die. The firstborn of the Pharaoh, buying people back from Satan is not a fun thing, and God doesn't enjoy this. And the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and the firstborn of all the animals, and there will be a great cry. And so Pharaoh himself was powerless to stop this next plague, this last god Pharaoh, which included the death of his firstborn, the next descendant of Ra, the next god figure to the Egyptians. There was no longer any doubt in that the Egyptian gods were in total powerless before the God of Israel. So this is God revealing himself, and he did so very effectively, although very painfully, but it was the only way that was going to work. The true God, and with this Pharaoh too, was shown powerless even to himself, and let the Israelites go. The purpose of these plagues, again, is to teach your sons' sons, your children's children, the coming generations up to this end time, as we watch for a coming similar judgment by God on a world that has chosen Satan. Just as Pharaoh, who is a type of Satan, refused to let Israel leave Egypt, sin type of the world, this present Satan-led world of religious confusion. And that's where we are today, and that's where we're going. There's a total lack of understanding. No God, no idea who God really is, and it's getting worse. Just as Pharaoh wouldn't let Israel go, Satan will not give up his hold on present humanity easily. It will take the end time plagues foreseen by type and what we've just gone through today, defeating the gods of the world, and with many parallels to what we've seen here in Egypt, to gain humanity's release from Satan. Many similarities between foreshadowing the plagues of Egypt and the trumpet plagues are, again, an interesting thing. And we won't go there, but if we did, Revelation 11:6, changing water to blood, something we saw here in Egypt. They, and it refers to the two witnesses, have the power to shut up the heavens so that it will not rain. During the time they are prophesying, and they have the power to turn water into blood, to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want. So they can stop rain, they can turn the water into blood. Revelation 16:3-5, the second angel poured out his bowl on the sea and turned into blood. I think this probably corresponds with the time when the two witnesses say, you need to listen. Okay, here's the plague. we're going to turn the water to blood. And here we find this second angel pouring out its bowl on the sea, and just as requested of the two witnesses, possibly, it happened. We saw frogs in Egypt representing a false god of theirs and therefore of Satan. In Revelation 16, 12 to 13, we similarly see frogs and false spirits associated with Satan poured out by the sixth angel. The sixth angel poured out his bowl in the great river Euphrates, and the water was dried up to prepare for the way of the kings. And you wonder, why was it dried up? Is this at the request of the two witnesses who had stopped the rains? This river was dried up, and then the frogs, it was dried up. And then I saw three impure spirits that looked like frogs. They came out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophet. These individuals and Satan with them who will be coming present. And it's like Exodus 8:6. Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and frogs covered the land. We have boils, sores, Revelation 16:2. The first angel went and poured out his bowl on the land, and ugly, festering sores broke out on the people who had the mark of the beast and worshipped its image. We have hail, Revelation 16:21. From the sky, huge hailstorms, each weighing about 100 pounds, fell on people, and they cursed God. And this is looking ahead, on account of the plague of hail, because the plague was so terrible. Revelation 9:3, we have locusts. Out of the smoke, locusts came down the earth, were given power like that of scorpions on the earth. These were a different kind of locusts, representing war machines, tormenting men rather than harming vegetation. And Revelation 16:10-11, we have darkness. Again, similar, as God is doing this in the end time. The fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast. This beast's power, this coming government over there, the kingdom, was plunged into darkness. People gnawed their tongues in agony and cursed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, but they refused to repent of what they had done. So you can see we're going to go through this again. A similar manifestation, it will be the last one, the last time. As the first three plagues of Egypt also affected God's people, God's physical nation, because they also have things to learn as a lesson for them in the ways of Egypt, the world, ultimately leading to death, God's people too will be affected by what we're moving into, this coming judgment on Satan's world. And so we know that, and we expect some of that. But at some point, as we move into Jacob's trouble, in this time of plagues again, God will offer protection to a small church first. How far we'll go into this time of judgment will remain to be seen. Ultimately, however, God, as he delivered ancient Israel from the hand of Pharaoh, he will also deliver his church, his people, and then this world from Satan. At that point, we can begin finally the life for which God created his children.